So the title of today's seminar or workshop is about mindfulness, bliss and beyond, just how we can use these traditional practices of meditation for huge amounts of benefits. Because when people learn how to meditate well, there's no end of scientific papers which say the benefits of meditation. When you can learn how to meditate, oh, there's so many amazing results. I'm not sure if I told this story the last time I was here, but I'm not quite sure how Thailand is doing in sport. How many medals did it win in the last Olympic Games? Anyone know? 12. Two? Only five. Okay. I am now going to teach how you can double that score in the next Olympics in London, because this is a true story which happened in the 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney, Australia. The New South Wales government, which was sponsoring those Olympic Games, decided that all those thousands of athletes from around the world would not only need a place to rest at night and a place where they can eat, they would also need sometimes some religious or spiritual support. So the government arranged priests, imams, even a Buddhist monk who were resident in that village to help with the spiritual needs of those athletes as they occurred. And so one of those religious people was a Buddhist monk, a friend of mine, and he told this story. One afternoon, these three people came to see him. It was one of the athletes and her mother and father, who was staying with her to give her support. She was from Russia, and in spite of all the expectations, she had done so well, she had made it into the final of the 800 meters sprint. She'd never expected to get that far. In a couple of days' time, she will be competing for her country, in front of all of the TV cameras of the world. Imagine that. If you've ever got nervous at an exam or a sports match, imagine that it's Olympic Games, final, and you're going to run in a couple of days' time. Wow, that's, you know, ultimate scary stuff. She was so nervous that she wasn't sleeping at night and she could hardly train. And even though she wasn't a Buddhist and her parents weren't Buddhist, everybody in the world knows that Buddhism is a religion which teaches meditation. Basically, we invented it. And if Buddhists were more market-orientated, we'd have a patent about it. And we'll be charging patent rights for other people who teach meditation. But of course, that's nothing to do with Buddhism. Everything is shared for free. So they went to see the expert. And they pleaded with this monk. Is it working? Hello? Okay. Is that working now? They pleaded with this monk, "Can you teach our daughter how to meditate? At least so she can relax and sleep at night, so she can train, because she's going crazy. We're afraid that in 2 days' time, when she has to compete, she'll completely stuff up and mess up in front of all the TV cameras." And so this monk taught this girl some very simple Buddhist meditation, only for about half an hour, and then they went away. And because the monk doesn't look at TV, he didn't know what had happened, except a couple of days later, because he saw the whole family coming towards him. And he wrote about this in an article in the Sydney paper. He saw the three people coming towards him, the mum, the dad, and the little athlete in between. And the first thing he noticed was they were smiling. The next thing he noticed was the athlete, the girl, in between the mum and dad, had something on the end of a string which she was swinging. What do you think that could have been? And it's only when she came closer he could see the colour. Gold. She'd actually won the gold medal, completely beyond all expectations. And they'd all come to this monk to say thank you for his contribution in helping their daughter relax, and not just to achieve her potential, but to exceed her potential. Because that's sometimes what meditation can do. So, if anyone knows a minister of sports in the current government, please tell him or her that story and get the next Thai Olympic team to learn some meditation. The very least, the high jumpers should be able to levitate a few more inches over the bar and get a better medal. But that's only sort of joking. Because meditation, it relaxes you. When you're relaxed, your health improves. Physical problems improve. Things like emotional problems improve. You get more peaceful, you get more happy, you tend to argue less. And this is not just what the Buddha said in the scriptures. This is researched again and again and again throughout the world, to the point that there are many universities throughout the world who have departments. They call it of mindfulness, but it really means meditation. And now you can go to Oxford University and get a PhD in meditation, in mindfulness studies. Because even the British government realizes that people who practice mindfulness or meditation, it enhances their academic ability. In other words, you get more clever and you can pass the exams easily. You can not spend so much time on your homework and more time doing the other things which you enjoy in life. There's one professor, she's over at Harvard, and she published a result about 18 months ago which showed that people who've been meditating for 7 years. And she compared that group just with a control group, about the same age, same economic status. And she found out by giving these people MRI scans that the people who meditated, their brains grew in size significantly over and above those who didn't meditate. Physically, your brain gets bigger when you meditate, she found. You get more gigabytes between your ears. So it makes it easier to do things. And that's, you see the research. And even the emotional problems like anxiety, attention deficit disorders, depression. In UK, the British National Health Service wanted to find out what's the best way to use their limited amount of money to treating many diseases. They were investigating how best to treat depression. They compared three treatments in clinical trials. The three treatments of medication, the pills, counseling, and lastly, meditation. They did huge trials, and when they published the results about 12 months ago, it was very clear medication had very little effect. Counseling had an effect, but none of those two treatments worked as well as meditation. Meditation was the clear winner, and now in the British National Health Service, a huge health provider in a modern country, the preferred treatment for anyone coming into their surgeries with depression is meditation. That's how powerful this meditation is in worldly ways, let alone sort of in understanding deeper things about life. As you do meditate more and more and you learn how to meditate, not only do you find out what peace of mind is and how to get some peace of mind in life, how to relax, not just physically but mentally, and have some peace and happiness in your life, but you find just how much happiness that can be. That's what wasn't said in my biography, and one of the most powerful moments of my life, which made me become a monk, was as a student doing my first meditation retreat and managing to get into a very deep state of mind in meditation. And I was so blissful, and it was a bliss better than sex. And that blew me away, to actually experience, just sitting on a meditation cushion, a happiness and a pleasure and a peace which was better than sexual intercourse, was something which I thought afterwards, why hasn't anyone told me about this before? And that gets you very interesting. Why is that the case? The bliss is actually part of meditation. So when we're meditating, if the meditation is working, it should be making you more and more happy, more profoundly happy, more deeply happy, more intensely happy. And if there's any Buddhists here who know the theory, you should know that the Buddha said that enlightenment is the ultimate happiness. Nibbanang paramang sukhang, that's the Pali. And the more you get closer to enlightenment, the more peaceful you get, the more happy you are. Until you get this incredible happy states of mind. That's actually the power of meditation. Just the sort of things it can do. Even these days, this other story, which I'm not sure if I've shared here, there was a Vietnamese monk who went to Australia to teach a meditation retreat, a 9-day retreat where people have residential retreat facilities, basically meditate all day, nothing else to do, walk, sit, relax, rest, and meditate for 9 days. And this monk, on a Friday evening, so we began with like a half an hour meditation, and then there was supposed to be a talk, and after the talk, questions and answers, and everyone go to bed, and the same routine the next day. After half an hour, he hadn't come out of his meditation yet. So they kept on meditating, he wasn't giving the talk. It got to 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, he was still meditating. 11 o'clock, people thought, well, he's not coming out of meditation, we better go to bed. So they all left and went back to bed. When they got up in the morning, he was still sitting there, hadn't moved. He meditated all night, and throughout the next day, and through the next night. For the whole 9 days, he did not move. Didn't go to the toilet, took no water, just sat there, perfectly still. Now that's what I call a monk. They're the good ones. It's nice to see there's still some around these days. And people can actually sit that still and that peaceful, not move for 9 days. And it still can be done. It's still being done. That shows you just how powerful and profound this meditation can be. And how it gets these amazing insights about the nature of you and the world and how it all works. Has been from time immemorial. People have been saying the truth within you. You understand the Dhamma not by reading books, but you understand it deep inside. Once, there was this very wealthy man in Bangkok, and he'd read in the newspaper about this new restaurant which had opened up, a 5-star restaurant. So he wanted to go and taste the food. He rang up, he had to make a reservation. The next available reservation was in about 3 months' time. It was such a popular restaurant, it was that highly booked. So he made a reservation anyway. When it got to the date of his reservation, he had to dress well because it's a very expensive elite restaurant. He turned up, they checked his reservation, he had one, so they led him to the table. This maitre d' in this very fine suit led him to the table. Because it was a very expensive restaurant, they gave him the menu, which was on thick card, you know, with gold lettering. An amazing menu. So the maitre d' gave him the menu, and then he looked at the menu, he ate the menu, paid, and left. The very silly guy, because he didn't know the difference between the menu and the food. It's the same way that some people know all the theory about Buddhism. They can recite Pali, and they can know the Tipitaka backwards. They know all about menus, they've eaten the menus, but they never ordered the food. So please remember the difference between the menu and the food. The menu is just the words, the food is experiencing it. What we're talking about, like a bliss better than sex, what we talk about by mindfulness, by peace of mind. And it's those experiences is what we mean by insight and understanding. You're understanding these things because you're experiencing them. And some of these experiences, they do change your whole life. The way you look at life, the way you understand life. For example, when you get into such deep states of meditation, your whole body disappears. It's gone. You can't see. You can't hear anything. Somebody will come and shout in your ear, "It's time for lunch! It's time for lunch!" You can't hear a thing. You can't feel the body. Someone might tap you on the shoulder and you will not feel it. But you're not unconscious. You're deep inside the mind, peaceful, blissful, but your external five senses are completely subdued. Now you're understanding what the mind truly is. This sixth sense in Buddhism called the mind. Do you know what the mind is? Sometimes people might have all of these theories about the mind. But that's all they are, just theories. We want to understand for ourselves, to feel and experience it. I developed the following simile many years ago. Once there was an emperor. The emperor was very, very powerful. The most powerful thing in the whole kingdom. However, no one knew who the emperor was. Because whenever the emperor appeared in public, the emperor was completely obscured and covered by five pieces of clothing. He had, I wouldn't say he, because no one knew whether it was a he or a she, whether it was gay or whether it was a monkey. No one knew what was underneath, because the being, the emperor, had boots, which not just covered his feet, went right up his calves, covered his knees, and finished halfway up his thighs. He had trousers which overlapped the top of his boots and came way above his waist. Had a jacket which covered the top of his trousers, went right down to his wrists and up to his neck. Had gloves which not just covered his hands but overlapped his sleeves of his jacket. And lastly, had a helmet on. A helmet which overlapped the top of his jacket. So there's no part of his body could be seen, all obscured by the five pieces of clothing, the boots, the trousers, the jacket, the helmet and the gloves. So no one knew whether that emperor was Caucasian, African, Thai, Eskimo, girl, boy, old or young. No one knew, because they could not see what was underneath. And that's just like our mind. Our mind is totally obscured by the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch. that we can't really understand what this emperor is inside of us, the one who decides what you're going to do and say, the one who feels the pain and the joy of life, the one who thinks and experiences, that's so covered up by these five pieces of clothing. No one knows whether your mind is a boy or a girl, whether your mind is Thai or Australian or African or Chinese, because it's totally covered up. So one of the jobs of meditation is to take away the clothes which obscure the mind. Take away the five senses until you can't see, you can't hear, smell, taste or touch, but you're fully aware, but deep inside, not thinking, but still, peaceful, awake, fully awake, just experiencing your own mind and knowing from experience what your mind is like. Now that's real insight. Things which come out of that insight, first thing which comes up out of that insight is you know from direct experience that your mind is totally independent of your body. So when your body dies, you know the mind will continue on. That's a very clear insight. Not thought, not so some deduction, but clear experience of what happens in deep insight. You'll never have any more doubts about things like reincarnation or rebirth. You know that, experience it. It's there. Example, one of my favorite stories about one of my disciples in Perth, an Australian man. He'd only usually meditate for maybe half an hour at most, but he liked his meditation. So one Sunday afternoon, not having much to do and nothing on the TV, he decided to go to his bedroom and meditate. So he went into his bedroom and sat down and started meditating. 1 hour later, he hadn't come out of his room. Hour and a half, still hadn't come out. Maybe 2 hours or so, his wife started to get concerned. So she went into the bedroom to check that he was all right. She went into that room and he saw him sitting there, meditating, after 2 hours. Perfectly still. Actually, too perfectly still. She couldn't see him breathing. She went closer, and his chest was immobile. It wasn't going up and down at all. So, she called emergency number, and an ambulance came. The siren. Rushing to his room. And then when they came into his room, these were trained medics, people who can actually find out quickly how you are. They saw he wasn't breathing at all. They checked his pulse. There was no pulse. So they immediately put him in the stretcher, wheeled him into the back of the ambulance, and went at top speed with the siren blaring, all the way to the hospital. This was emergency. The guy looked like he was dead. So they wheeled him into the ER room. And there the doctors did a preliminary check. They couldn't see any pulse or any breath. So they put on an ECG to his heart. As soon as they connected up the monitor, ding, 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 emergency, flat line. I've been told by doctors, and Dr. Nunn will probably tell me, that actually that machine doesn't go ding, 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 ding. But it makes it much better when I'm telling the talk to make it go ding, 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 ding. But it was an emergency. The heart had stopped. And then they put on an EEG to his brain to see if there was any brain activity, if he was brain dead. Another flat line. The guy was brain dead. Now that's pretty extreme. But it was very lucky that that day the doctor on duty in the ER room was an Indian guy. If he'd been an Australian, they'd have sent him straight down to the morgue. And that would have been very dangerous, because when he came out of meditation later, he'd have probably killed the two attendants in the morgue. Imagine what it's like. You've got like a stiff in the morgue, sort of a dead person, they suddenly sort of wake up and come alive. That's very scary. But because it was an Indian guy, the Indian had heard from his father that sometimes people can get into such deep meditation, they can suspend all their life activities. And the doctor knew this guy had been meditating. And it was no other cause for his heart and his brain stopping. So he decided to give him a chance. They put defibrillators on his chest. The electric shocks, which makes you jump off the bench out of the electric shock. Many, many times they tried to shock his heart into beating. But nothing worked. Until he just decided, he told me, he just decided time to come out of meditation. He opened his eyes. He bent up. And at that point, beep, beep, beep. The ECG and the EG were then perfect. And the doctor gave him a checkup. He was perfectly healthy. He actually walked home. And that was a wonderful story, because that was a time where a person had gone into such a deep meditation. Their brain and their body had completely stopped, but they were perfectly alert. I asked him, "What were you aware of?" He said, "Oh, the most beautiful bliss and peace I've ever experienced in my life. In the deep meditations where the body completely disappears." So he's one who's had a deep experience of meditation. So the insight which he's got there, he knows what it's like to die, because that's what happened to him. His body just stopped. But his mind continued on, awake, strong, and very blissful. So people like that know what's going to happen to them when they die. And because they know what's going to happen to them when they die, they're not afraid of death anymore. I don't know why it is. People go big, big thing about dying. You've died before. Next time you die, here we go again. Maybe make a better job of it this time you did last time. So we're not so afraid of these things. We understand sort of the bigger picture of life. And these are just some of the things which happen to you when you get into nice meditation. Or like some of my disciples love to do. And why not? It's in those deep meditations when you come out afterwards. When your mind is very, very strong and powerful. The way the Buddha described it, he said it's like your mind is malleable, like pure gold. And like a jeweler can, when all the impurities are taken out of gold, then the jeweler can actually bend it and mold it into this amazing, refined jewelry. But if there's any imperfections there, it's too hard and brittle. But when your mind is rid of all these impurities, and you come out of a deep meditation, it's just so easy. It's like a well-trained dog. You just go and tell the dog to go and pick up the newspaper, and it just does it, wagging its tail all the way there and back. And that's what your mind is like after you come out of a nice deep meditation. Just ask it to do something, and it does it. So you ask it, "What is my earliest memory?" It's really interesting when you do that. What is my earliest memory? And then you find there are two different types of memories. There's the ordinary memory which you are used to, which is just recording the last time you remembered something. It's not a memory which goes right back to the past and re-experiences it. These are the memories you get when you say, "What's my earliest memory?" It's a re-experiencing something from your past. As a monk, I've got to be very careful because I've got very strict rules. I can't reveal too much about what happens when I meditate But there is a little loophole. As long as it's concerned with this life, I can tell. And so I usually tell the story. The first time I did this, after a nice deep meditation, coming out afterwards, I asked myself, what's my earliest memory? What came up straight away was a smell. There was an aroma, a scent in my nose, which I recognized almost immediately. That was the smell of my baby's pram when I was an infant, maybe 2 or 3 weeks old. I recognized the surroundings by their scent. And as soon as that recognition came up, even though I had my eyes closed, I think I was in Australia at the time, just meditating, I was back there in my pram as a 2 or 3 week old infant, feeling, exploring and seeing all those things around me which I'd forgotten about so many years earlier. These memories were re-experiencing of the past. Not the usual way we remember things. It's like you're back there, you're right there, and you can move around and explore. Fascinating experience to be a baby again, to feel it totally. Later on, when I told that experience to a couple of close disciples, again, one was a doctor, and I was never trained in medicine or in much in biology. I was a physicist more. But people told me afterwards that when a baby is born, the most dominant sense is the sense of smell. And it's true, I know that from personal experience now, that a baby recognizes its mother and father from its smell. You recognize its bed, its pram, its playthings by their smell, not so much by what you see of them. So if you're a mum with a new baby, it's all right to change your hair or change your clothes, but please don't change your perfume. You'll confuse the hell out of your baby. Because that's what she recognizes, that's the baby recognizes you by, your smell. So you get all these amazing insights in deep meditation, what happens, and also you can go further back. And that's the fun part, when you say, earlier, please, and find out what it's like to be a fetus in the womb of your mother, to feel it. Earlier, please, and remember things from a time and place far distant from where you're sitting now, to remember your previous existences, your previous lives. It can be done. It is being done. And what that does, that answers a question. What happens after death? Or where did you come from anyway? Too often people ask those questions philosophically. They can argue about them, debate them. That doesn't cut any ice at all. It doesn't help. But re-experiencing these things, knowing who you were before, then that really changes a lot the way you look about life and death, and about the big picture of just one life amongst many hundreds. It puts many things in perspective. And again, it does change much of the way you look about life. And remember, this isn't theory. You're not being asked to believe this. It's not taken on authority just because some monk or some teacher or some book says it. This is open to each one of you to experience if you really want to. Just practice the deep meditations and see what happens. So those are some of the effects of meditating. That's why I call mindfulness bliss and beyond. It's beyond into the great insights, which is usually the part of religion. But the one thing about Buddhism I've always liked is Buddhism is what I call a realized religion, not a revealed religion. A revealed religion is when you're told what to believe. A realized religion is when you're told how to find out. It's a great difference between those two. Buddhism has never been, or should never be, a revealed religion. No monk, no matter how big, wise, powerful, no nun, no professor, no authority, has the right to tell you what to believe. Their job is to tell you how to find out for yourself. That's the job of a teacher. Teaching you how to learn, not teaching you what they think is true. That's why Buddhism is a realized religion. It's not revealed to you. It's told, here are the tools, here's how to do it, you go off and find out. That's a tough ask of people, but it's really the only way where you can really trust what you know. So that way, meditation is the path of finding out. That's why it's always been central to Buddhism. So much so that if ever I have to go and give talks at schools or universities, especially schools in Australia, it's a common question that children ask me, in Christianity, the holy book is the Bible. In Islam, the holy book is the Quran. In Judaism, the holy book is the Torah. In Hinduism, the holy book is maybe the Vedas, maybe Upanishads. In Buddhism, what's the holy book of Buddhism? You know what the holy book of Buddhism is? Meditation. Don't say Tripitaka, that's a menu. The meditation, that's a holy book, because that's what you read. That's what you consult to find out the truth of things. So the holy book of Buddhism is meditation. That's why meditation is so, so important. And number two, it's not that hard to do. People make it hard. And the reason why people make it hard is because most of your life, whatever you've achieved in life, at school, at sport, in your career, you've had to struggle for. You've had to work hard at school. Work hard in your career, even work hard in your relationship. Work hard bringing up your kids. Work hard to keep your health good. So much in life you've achieved by working hard. You don't get anywhere in meditation by working hard. It goes in completely the opposite direction, which is why one of the most profound stories before the Buddha became enlightened was when he put his bowl, his alms bowl, in the Niranjala River and made a determination, if I am to be enlightened, the Buddha's to be said, may my bowl flow against the current, go upstream instead of down. And it did. That was the story. What it meant was not just an omen or prediction that he was about to become enlightened. It also showed him something of how to be enlightened, the way to enlightenment, going against the stream. Now I think hopefully you can understand the meaning here. The stream which we're talking about there is the stream of controlling, doing, making it happen, working hard, forcing, struggling. That might work in life, but it never works in meditation. It just makes you more tense, tired, and frustrated. And too many people give up saying, oh, I can't meditate. You can. It just, you're going about it in the wrong way. So this is how to meditate. This is a standard story. It's based on what Ajahn Chah said, but he used his hand. I use a glass of water. See this glass of water here. Maybe kids, Boone, and your friends can help me here. I'm going to try and hold this glass of water absolutely still. So it takes a lot of concentration and focus to hold it still. So I'm going to focus on this water. Now, Boone, is it still yet? It's moving. Okay, so I'll try harder. Is it still yet? Come on, Ajahn Brahm. How long have you got to do this for? Come on. Is it still yet? This is how most people meditate. trying to hold their mind still. And you always get these thoughts coming up into your mind. You know, you get these feelings in your body, distractions, you just can't keep it still. However, there is a very simple way of getting this glass of water to be absolutely still. You all know what that is. You put it down. As soon as you put it down, it moves more than usual. As soon as you do this meditation, sometimes your mind goes more sleepy than usual. You can even get more restless than usual, but just be patient. Now, Bun, that water there, is that still? Yeah, and you're not just saying that because you're a friend. You can actually argue with me. I won't sort of get upset at you. That's actually perfectly still. There's no way that I or anyone else could hold that water that still. Now that's how we meditate. We actually literally let go of things. We stop controlling, we stop doing things, we stop making things happen. We let go. Now what do we let go of is the next question. What we let go of is that thing inside of us which says, come on, let go, let go, let go, let go. That controller, that's what we want to let go of. That's why it's so tricky. But once you get the hang of it, you understand the way of meditation is just stopping this thing inside of you which is always trying to make things happen. Because at first that's a difficult thing to do, have all these many techniques of like tricking you how to let go and do nothing. First of those techniques is to let go of all of the past and all of the future, being in the present moment. Such a simple idea, but very powerful if you do it properly and you do it for long enough. All of your past, what's happened to you so far in your life? Can you change it? Can you do anything about it? Of course you can't. Just thinking in of the past is just giving yourself more business to do. So because you can't do anything, it can't be changed, the past is none of my business. Isn't it nice actually to put all that business away? When we leave here, do you have to clean up? You don't. Maybe Noon and her friends have to. But you, this is none of your business. As soon as it's finished here, you can just walk away and go home. Isn't that nice? All of the past business, the things which have happened to you so far in your life, you just walk away and leave the past to clean it up. Isn't that nice? It doesn't matter what's happened to you so far in your life. None of it is your business right now. You can completely let it go. I don't know why it is that people imprison themselves with their past. Have you had a lovely day today or this week? Have you got upset about something which happened to you today or last week? If it was really painful, why can't you let it go? It's absolutely ridiculous. It's crazy to carry around the pain of the past. For example, there's this one guy, he complained to me that someone called him an idiot. Now, if someone calls you an idiot, number one, the reason you might get upset, in fact, the only reason that anyone gets upset when they're called an idiot is because they believe the other person might be onto something. They might be right. It's true. If someone called you an idiot, the only reason you get angry is if you believe they're right. And if you do get angry, they were right. You are an idiot. So really, if someone calls you an idiot, you just, no, they're wrong. End of story. But a lot of times what happens, someone calls you an idiot and you think, why did they call me an idiot? They've no right to call me an idiot. They shouldn't call me an idiot. And you recognize you've now allowed them to call you an idiot 3 more times. Every time you remember about it and think about it, they're calling you an idiot again. It's true. So they call you an idiot. At least only allow them to call you an idiot once. So you don't even remember it. You don't even think about it. Because every time you think about it, You're allowing them to call you an idiot one more time. Don't give them that pleasure. So that way we can actually let go of the past really easily. And even the happy moments of the past, I'll leave that alone. That stops you having a happy present moment. And as for the future, where is your future made? When is the only time you can do something about your future? Now. Right now, you are building your health, your happiness, and prosperity. Right in this moment. Nowhere else is it built. Only now. So if you really care about your future, if you want a happy, healthy, prosperous future, put more effort and attention into this present moment. Because this is the place where your future is made. Now. Someone once told me this lovely quote. You know that some people are wealthy, some people are sort of all right, but even if you're poor, you've got some money. You know what stops you enjoying your money? Because you want more. Every time you want something, stops you enjoying what you already have. It's a lovely little anecdote there, lovely saying. Every time you want something, it stops you enjoying what you already have. Every time you want something else, it stops you enjoying what you already have. I repeated that a couple of times. It's very powerful. Sometimes we're always working so hard, always wanting something more. Always wanting something more. We never pause to enjoy what we have ever in our life. Years go past, we haven't really enjoyed anything. We've always been working for the next thing, going to the next goal, always moving to the next station in life, always on the run, never sitting still and appreciating this moment. You're supposed to have holidays in life. What happens when people go have a holiday? They've either got to go and do all the work and jobs in their house, or go shopping, or go overseas. Why is it that people spend such a lot of money on their house? As soon as they've got a chance, they go overseas and abandon it. Why can't you just stop every now and again and just enjoy what you already have? That ability just to stop and enjoy what you already have, to find contentment in this moment with what you have, is part of the trick of how to meditate. Learning how to be content and grateful in this moment with what you have, to rest. So that afterwards, after this half an hour, an hour of contentment, then you can go work hard. Having rested, relaxed, regenerated your energies, it's amazing what you can do then. But now, in meditation, it's time just to relax and be content with what you have, no matter what that is. So when we let go of the past and the future, we came into this present moment, you have to be content with this present moment. It might not be the best present moment. You might be tired, you might be aching, you might be itching. Does not matter. Your job is to be content with this moment. Allow it to be. Open the door of your heart to this moment. Embrace it with kindness, with respect. Make peace with this moment. If you can make peace with this moment, then maybe you might find some peace in life. If you make war with this moment, are you going to find any peace by fighting battles? No, never. So you can make peace with this moment. When people say, I can't meditate, I say, it's always because you want something. You can always make peace with this moment. You can always be kind to what you're experiencing right now. You can always be gentle and patient. Therefore, you can always meditate. Your job is just to do that. Being kind, being peaceful, being gentle, being patient. And you'll find that that is what meditation is. Building up this attitude of mind. What you're meditating on, in other words, what you're experiencing, doesn't really matter. You could be asleep, you could be restless, or you could be watching the breath, you can be doing buddho. That is irrelevant. What really matters is what you're doing with buddho. That's one of the meditation methods. What you're doing with the breath, how you're reacting to the sleepiness or the restlessness. Are you making peace with it? Are you being kind? Are you being gentle? Are you being patient? I call being kind, being peaceful, being gentle, being patient, I call that making good meditation karma. If you make good karma, you get good results. So all you need to do is keep on being kind, being peaceful, being gentle, being patient. And of course, the mind slows down, the mind becomes still, and you experience meditation. You think, wow, how easy it is when I stop trying to make it happen. When I just make peace with things, be kind, be gentle, be patient, and all these wonderful meditation methods, they just happen. Here's a nice little story for some of you from the time when I was a monk with Ajahn Chah. I don't think I've ever said this here in, could have done, I'm not sure. This is one of Ajahn Chah's similes, which is in no book that I know of. Because when I first went up there about 34 years ago, he was always going on the same simile, week after week. He said his monastery, Wat Nong Bapong in Ubon, he said it's a mango orchard. Actually, there were a few mangoes there, but he wasn't meaning a real orchard. And he said the mango trees were planted by the Buddha hundreds of years ago, he said. And now all those trees are mature, the mangoes are ripe, and there are hundreds of them on each tree, just so juicy and sweet. And he said, these days you monks, you don't need to climb the tree to get the mango. You don't need to throw a stick or a stone up or beat the branch with a stick to get the mango. He said, you monks, all you need to do is just to put your hand out and a mango will fall. And I thought that was daft. You try that, you go home under a mango tree and put your hand out. You'll be there for weeks before one falls. And if it does, it probably just falls to the left or the right. Not into your heart. So I never understood that simile at all. I thought it was one of Ajahn Chah's stupid similes. But only later on, when you understand this letting go business, do you understand what it meant? If you go climbing that tree, mangoes will never fall. If you shake that tree, they won't fall. If you throw sticks and stones up there, if you try and make those mangoes fall, no way. If you just put your hand out, open your mind, let go, be peaceful, then the mango falls right into the middle of your hand. So sweet. If you just let go, be peaceful, be kind, be gentle and patient, then these beautiful fruits come to you. Not when you rush after them or try and make them happy. It's the letting go. Understand the letting go, you just put your hand out and it falls. It's a very beautiful simile of one of the great monks of Thailand. And he came up with some amazing similes sometimes. He used to say one of his similes, because last time I was in there, was it last January? No, not, maybe 13 months ago. And whenever you go visiting these old temples, you get lots of nostalgia, you know, and you keep on telling the other monks, oh, in the old days, it was much tougher than this. Oh, you monks don't know what it's like today. In the old... You know what it's like, people talk about the old days. But I remember once, because we went right past the spot where Ajahn Chah did this. And of course it brought back all these memories. Coming back from alms round. And Ajahn Chah would always take opportunities to teach you. And he picked up a stick from the side of the road, turned around to me and said, is the stick heavy? Before I had a chance to answer, he'd thrown the stick into the bush. And he said, a stick is only heavy when you're holding it. When it's in the bush, you've let it go, it's not heavy anymore. Is the death of a loved one heavy? Only when you're holding it, when you've thrown it away, it's not heavy anymore. Is the financial crisis heavy? Is your cancer heavy? It's only when you're holding it it's heavy. Is your meditation heavy? Only when you're holding it. If you throw it away, not heavy anymore. Now this is part of meditation. The reason why we don't get peaceful, we hold on to too many things. So we just throw it away. Past and future, throw it away. I like this wonderful saying, none of my business. I love that little saying now. The past is none of my business. The future, none of my business. My body, none of my business. Body can look after itself. Then you go deeper. The past, future, none of my business. All these thoughts which come into my mind, all these ideas, none of my business. It's amazing when you say none of my business, everything disappears. And then my mind, none of my business either. It's great, I've got no business in meditation, nothing to do. Just sit here, do absolutely nothing. Isn't that wonderful? Have a rest. When you've got no business at all to do, nowhere to go, nothing to achieve, nothing missing, nothing lacking, no business at all, free at last. Can you do that? Easy, just say, none of my business. Now if you can really do that, it's a beautiful way of letting go. And the mind gets very, very still. See, because after you get into present moment awareness and silence, the next thing which sometimes it helps people to let go of is learning how to be silent. So many people, especially new meditators, said, I can't stop thinking. When I close my eyes, I'm always thinking about something. They say it's impossible for me not to think. And I've got this method now to prove to you 100% that you, each one of you, can stop thinking. And I'm now going to prove it to you. A nice exercise for you. Because as I'm speaking, I also want you not just to listen to what I'm saying, but also listen to your reaction to what I'm saying in your mind. So pay some attention to what's happening inside of you as I'm speaking. Because as I'm going to speak, you will begin to notice that there are going to be many pauses between my words. In those spaces, between my words, what was happening in your mind? You were silent. You weren't thinking anything. Because you never knew when I was going to start speaking again. That's a great trick. But it also means that you were listening, aware, without a thought going on in your mind in those spaces. It's because you never knew when I was going to start next. And you wasn't really quite sure what was going to happen. That's why you stopped. You're aware, fully awake, fully listening, but not thinking. Once you can recognize those states of silence, awareness without thinking, you'll find there's more moments of silence in your life than you recognized before. You are silent very often. But the thing is, you pay no attention to those silent moments. You only pay attention to the busyness, to the thinking. When you start paying attention to the silence, it's so nice. The pauses between things in life. Once you recognize silence, it grows on you. Becomes a lovely refuge. You can wait in the moment. Isn't that lovely? So now you understand how silence is and how easy it is. But you can't do silence. You have to just stop the doing and silence is there. Present moment awareness, silence. And then you find the mind gets very still. Sometimes you can do things like on the breath or Buddha or these other things. Some of you know how to do those because that's standard meditation. Today I began by talking about the preparations. And preparation is the most important thing of anything. Getting the understanding, the attitude right, and learning especially how to be in the present moment and how to be silent. Later on this afternoon, we may talk about more things about the breath and other meditation methods. But I think that's enough talking for now. Because I want to do a half an hour guided meditation before we actually go anywhere else.